will help you discover and develop the power of the I can do better attitude. Each day, before you begin work, devote 10 minutes to thinking, how can I do a better job today? Ask, what can I do today to encourage my employees? What special favor can I do for my customers? How can I increase my personal efficiency? This exercise is simple, but it works. Try it, and you'll find unlimited creative ways to win greater success. Just about every time my wife and I would get together with a certain couple, the conversation would turn to working wives. Mrs. S. had worked several years before her marriage, and she had genuinely liked it. But now, she'd say, I've got two youngsters in school, a home to manage, and meals to prepare. I simply haven't got time. Then, one Sunday evening, Mr. and Mrs. S. and their children were in an automobile accident. Mrs. S. and the youngsters escaped serious injury, but Mr. S. received a back injury that left him permanently disabled. Now, Mrs. S. had no choice but to go to work. When we saw her several months after the accident, we were amazed to find how well she had adjusted to her new responsibilities. You know, she said, 6 months ago I never dreamed I could possibly manage the house and work full-time. But after the accident, I just made up my mind that I had to find the time. Believe me, my efficiency has gone up 100%. I discovered a lot of things I was doing didn't need to be done at all. Then I discovered that the children could and wanted to help. I found dozens of ways to conserve time. Fewer trips to the store, less TV, less telephoning, less of those time killers. This experience teaches us a lesson. Capacity is a state of mind. How much we can do depends on how much we think we can do. When you really believe you can do more, your mind thinks creatively and shows you the way. A young bank executive related this personal experience about work capacity. One of the other executives in our bank left us with very short notice. This put our department on the spot. The fellow leaving had filled an important job, and his work couldn't be postponed or left undone. The day after he left, the vice president in charge of my department called me in. He explained to me that he had already talked individually to the two others in my group, asking them if they could divide the work of the man who had just left until a replacement could be found. Neither of them flatly refused, said the vice president, but each stated that he is up to his neck now with his own pressing work. I'm wondering if you could handle some of the overload temporarily? Throughout my working career, I've learned that it never pays to turn down what looks like an opportunity. So I agreed and promised to do my very best to handle all the vacated job as well as keep up with my own work. The vice president was pleased at this. I walked out of his office knowing I had taken on a big job. I was just as busy as the two others in my department who had wiggled out of this extra duty. But I was determined to find a way to handle both jobs. I finished up my work that afternoon, and when the offices were closed, I sat down to figure out how I could increase my personal efficiency. I got a pencil and started writing down every idea I could think of. And you know, I came up with some good ones, like working out an arrangement with my secretary to channel all routine telephone calls to me during a certain hour each day, placing all outgoing calls during a certain hour, cutting my usual conference periods from 15 minutes to 10, giving all my dictation at one time each day. I also discovered my secretary could and was eager to take over a number of little time-consuming details for me. I had been handling my present job for over 2 years, and frankly, I was amazed to discover how much inefficiency I had let creep in. Within a week's time, I was dictating twice as many letters, handling 50% more phone calls, attending half again as many meetings, all with no strain. A couple more weeks passed. The vice president called me in. He complimented me on doing a fine job. He went on to say that he had looked over a number of people from both inside and outside the bank, but he had not yet found the right man. Then he confessed that he had already cleared with the bank's executive committee, and they had authorized him to combine the two jobs, put them both in my charge, and give me a substantial increase in salary. I proved to myself that how much I can do depends on how much I think I can do. Capacity is indeed a state of mind. Every day, it seems, this takes place in the fast-moving world of business. The boss calls in an employee and explains that a special task must be accomplished. Then he says, "I know you've got a lot of work to do, but can you handle this?" Too often the employee replies, "I'm awfully sorry, but I'm all loaded down now. I wish I could take it on, but I'm just too busy." Under the circumstances, the boss doesn't hold it against the employee because it is extra duty, so to speak. But the boss realizes the task must be done, and he'll keep on looking until he finds an employee who is just as busy as the rest, but who feels he can take on more. And this employee is the fellow who will forge ahead. In business, in the home, in the community, the success combination is do what you do better, improve the quality of your output, and do more of what you do, increase the quantity of your output. Convinced it pays to do more and better? Then try this two-step procedure. 1. Eagerly accept the opportunity to do more. It's a compliment to be asked to take on a new responsibility. Accepting greater responsibility on the job makes you stand out and shows that you're more valuable. When your neighbors ask you to represent them on a civic matter, accept. It helps you to become a community leader. 2. Next, concentrate on how can I do more? Creative answers will come. Some of these answers may be better planning and organization of your present work, or taking intelligent shortcuts in your routine activities, or possibly dropping non-essential activities altogether. But let me repeat, the solution for doing more will appear. As a personal policy, I have accepted fully the concept, if you want it done, give it to a busy man. I refuse to work on important projects with persons who have lots of free time. I have learned from painful, expensive experience that the fellow who has plenty of time makes an ineffective work partner. All the successful, competent people I know are busy. When I start something, some project with them, I know it will be satisfactorily completed. I have learned in dozens of instances that I can count on a busy man to deliver. But I have often been disappointed in working with people who have all the time in the world. Progressive business management constantly asks, what can we do to expand output? Why not ask yourself, what can I do to expand my output? Your mind will creatively show you how. In hundreds of interviews with people at all levels, I've made this discovery. The bigger the person, the more apt he is to encourage you to talk. The smaller the person, the more apt he is to preach to you. Big people monopolize the listening. Small people monopolize the talking. Note this also. Top-level leaders in all walks of life spend much more time requesting advice than they do in giving it. Before a top man makes a decision, he asks, "How do you feel about it? What do you recommend? What would you do under these circumstances? How does this sound to you?" Look at it this way. A leader is a decision-making human machine. Now, to manufacture anything, you've got to have raw material. In reaching creative decisions, the raw materials are the ideas and suggestions of others. Don't, of course, expect other people to give you ready-made solutions. That's not the primary reason for asking and listening. Ideas of others help to spark your own ideas, so your mind is more creative. Recently, I participated as a staff instructor in an executive management seminar. The seminar consisted of 12 sessions. One of the highlights of each meeting was a 15-minute discussion by one of the executives on the topic, How I Solved My Most Pressing Management Problem. At the ninth session, the executive whose turn it was, a vice president of a large milk processing company, did something different. Instead of telling how he had solved his problem, he announced his topic as needed, help on solving my most pressing management problem. He quickly outlined his problem and then asked the group for ideas on solving it. To be sure, he got a record of each idea suggested. He had a stenographer in the room taking down everything that was said. Later, I talked with this man and complimented him on his unique approach. His comment was, "There are some very sharp men in this group. I just figured I'd harvest some ideas. There's a good possibility something someone said during that session may give me the clue I need to solve the problem." Note, this executive presented his problem, then listened. In so doing, he got some decision-making raw material, and as a side benefit, the other executives in the audience enjoyed the discussion because it gave them the opportunity to take part. Successful businesses invest large sums in consumer research. They ask people about the taste, quality, size, and appearance of a product. Listening to people provides definite ideas for making the product more saleable. It also suggests to the manufacturer what he should tell consumers about the product in his advertising. The procedure for developing successful products is to get as much opinion as you can, listen to the people who will buy the product, and then design the product and its promotion to please these people. In an office recently, I noticed a sign that said, "To sell John Brown what John Brown buys, you've got to see things through John Brown's eyes." And the way to get John Brown's vision is to listen to what John Brown has to say. Your ears are your intake valves. They feed your mind raw materials that can be converted into creative power. We learn nothing from telling, but there is no limit to what we can learn by asking and listening. Try this 3-stage program to strengthen your creativity through asking and listening. 1. Encourage others to talk. In personal conversation or in group meetings, draw out people with little urges, such as, "Tell me about your experience," or "What do you think should be done about," or "What do you think is the key point?" Encourage others to talk, and you win a double-barreled victory. Your mind soaks up raw material that you can use to produce creative thought, and you win friends. There is no surer way to get people to like you than to encourage them to talk to you. 2. Test your own views in the form of questions. Let other people help you smooth and polish your ideas. Use the "What do you think of this suggestion?" approach. Don't be dogmatic. Don't announce a fresh idea as if it were handed down on a gold tablet. Do a little informal research first. See how your associates react to it. If you do, chances are you'll end up with a better idea. 3. Concentrate on what the other person says. Listening is more than just keeping your own mouth shut. Listening means letting what's said penetrate your mind. So often, people pretend to listen when they aren't listening at all. They're just waiting for the other person to pause so they can take over with the talking. Concentrate on what the other person says. Evaluate it. That's how you collect mind food. More and more leading universities are offering advanced management training programs for senior business executives. According to the sponsors, the big benefit of these programs is not that the executives get ready-made formulae that they can use to operate their business more efficiently. Rather, they benefit most from the opportunity to exchange and discuss new ideas. Many of these programs require the executives to live together in college dormitories, thus encouraging bull sessions. Boiled down to one word, the executives benefit most from the stimulation received. A year ago, I directed 2 sessions in a 1-week sales management school in Atlanta, sponsored by the National Sales Executives Incorporated. A few weeks later, I met a salesman friend who worked for one of the sales executives who'd attended the school. "You people at the school sure gave my sales manager a lot of things to do to run our company better," my young friend said. Curious, I asked him specifically what changes he'd noticed. He reeled off a number of things: a revision in the compensation plan, sales meetings twice a month instead of once a month, new business cards and stationery, a revision in sales territories, not one of which was specifically recommended in the training program. The sales manager didn't get a bunch of canned techniques. Instead, he got something much more valuable: the stimulation to think of ideas directly beneficial to his own particular organization. A young accountant for a paint manufacturer told me about a very successful venture of his that was sparked by the ideas of others. "I never had had more than a casual interest in real estate," he told me. "I've been a professional accountant for several years now, and I've stuck pretty close to my profession. One day, a realtor friend invited me to be his guest at a luncheon of one of the city's real estate groups. The speaker that day was an older man who had seen the city grow. His talk was about the next 20 years. He predicted that the metropolitan area would continue to grow far out into the surrounding farmland. He also predicted that there would be a record demand for what he called gentleman-size farms, 2 to 5 acres, big enough so the businessman or professional person could have a pool, horses, a garden, and other hobbies that require space. This man's talk really stimulated me. What he described was exactly what I wanted. The next few days, I asked several friends what they thought about the idea of someday owning a 5-acre estate. Everyone I talked to said, in effect, "I'd love that." I continued to think about it and to figure how I could turn the idea into profit. Then one day, as I was driving to work, the answer came out of nowhere: why not buy a farm and divide it into estates? I figured the land might be worth more in relatively small pieces than in one big piece. 22 miles from the center of the city, I found a worn-out 50-acre farm priced at $8,500. I bought it, paying only 1/3 down and working out a mortgage with the owner for the balance. Next, I planted pine seedlings where there were no trees. I did this because a real estate man, whom I feel knows his business, told me, "People want trees these days, lots of trees." I wanted my prospective buyers to see that in a few years, their estate would be covered with beautiful pine trees. Then I got a surveyor to divide the 50 acres into 10 5-acre plots. Now I was ready to start selling. I got several mailing lists of young executives in the city and put on a small-scale direct mail campaign. I pointed out how for only $3,000, the price of a small city lot, they could buy an estate. I also described the potentials for recreation and wholesome living. In 6 weeks' time, working only evenings and on weekends, I sold all 10 plots. Total income, $30,000. Total costs, including the land, advertising, surveying, and legal expenses, $10,400. Profit, $19,600. I made a nice profit because I let myself be exposed to ideas of other intelligent people. Had I not accepted that invitation to attend a luncheon with a group completely foreign to my occupational interests, my brain would have never worked out this successful plan for making a profit. There are many ways to get mental stimulation, but here are two that you can incorporate into your pattern of life. First, join and meet regularly with at least one professional group that provides stimulation in your own occupational area. Rub shoulders and minds with other success-oriented people. So often I hear someone say, "I picked up a great idea this noon at the blank meeting," or, "During the meeting yesterday, I got to thinking." Remember, a mind that feeds only on itself soon is undernourished, becoming weak and incapable of creative, progressive thought. Stimulation from others is excellent mind food. Second, join and participate in at least one group outside your occupational interests. Association with people who have different job interests broadens your thinking and helps you to see the big picture. You'll be surprised how mixing regularly with people outside your occupational area will stimulate your on-the-job thinking. Ideas are fruits of your thinking, but they've got to be harnessed and put to work to have value. Each year, an oak tree produces enough acorns to populate a good-sized forest. Yet from these bushels of seeds, perhaps only one or two acorns will become a tree. The squirrels destroy most of them, and the hard ground beneath the tree doesn't give the few remaining seeds much chance for a start. So it is with ideas. Very few bear fruit. Ideas are highly perishable. If we're not on guard, the squirrels, negative-thinking people, will destroy most of them. Ideas require special handling from the time they are born until they're transformed into practical ways for doing things better. Use these three ways to harness and develop your ideas. 1. Don't let ideas escape. Write them down. Every day, lots of good ideas are born only to die quickly because they aren't nailed to paper. Memory is a weak slave when it comes to preserving and nurturing brand new ideas. Carry a notebook or some small cards with you. When you get an idea, write it down. A friend who travels a lot keeps a clipboard beside him so that he can write down an idea the instant it occurs to him. People with fertile creative minds know a good idea may sprout anytime, anyplace. Don't let ideas escape, else you destroy the fruits of your thinking. Fence them in. 2. Next, review your ideas. File these ideas in an active file. The file can be an elaborate cabinet, or it can be a desk drawer. A shoebox will do. But build a file and then examine your storehouse of ideas regularly. As you go over your ideas, some may, for very good reasons, have no value at all. Get rid of them. But so long as the idea has any promise, keep it. 3. Cultivate and fertilize your idea. Now make your idea grow. Think about it. Tie the idea to related ideas. Read anything you can find that is in any way akin to your idea. Investigate all angles. Then, when the time is ripe, put it to work for yourself, your job, your future. When an architect gets an idea for a new building, he makes a preliminary drawing. When a creative advertising person gets an idea for a new TV commercial, he puts it into storyboard form, a series of drawings that suggest what the idea will look like in finished form. Writers with idea prepare a first draft. Note: shape up the idea on paper. There are two excellent reasons for this. When the idea takes tangible form, you can literally look at it, see the loopholes, see what it needs in the way of polish. Then, too, ideas have to be sold to someone. Customers, employees, the boss, friends, fellow club members, investors. Somebody must buy the idea, else it has no value. One summer, I was contacted by two life insurance salesmen. Both wanted to work on my insurance program. Both promised to return with a plan for making the needed changes. The first salesman gave me strictly an oral presentation. He told me in words what I needed. But I soon was confused. He brought in taxes, options, Social Security, all the technical details of insurance programming. Frankly, he lost me, and I had to say no. The second salesman used a different approach. He had charted his recommendations. All the details were shown in diagram form. I could grasp his proposal easily and quickly because I could literally see it. He sold me. Resolve to put your ideas in saleable form. An idea written or in some sort of picture or diagram form has many times more selling power than the idea presented only in oral form. Use these tools and think creatively. 1. Believe it can be done. When you believe something can be done, your mind will find the ways to do it. Believing a solution paves the way to solution. Eliminate impossible, won't work, can't do, no use trying from your thinking and speaking vocabularies. 2. Don't let tradition paralyze your mind. Be receptive to new ideas. Be experimental. Try new approaches. Be progressive in everything you do. 3. Ask yourself daily, how can I do better? There is no limit to self-improvement. When you ask yourself, how can I do better, sound answers will appear. Try it and see. 4. Ask yourself, how can I do more? Capacity is a state of mind. Asking yourself this question puts your mind to work to find intelligent shortcuts. The success combination in business is: do what you do better, improve the quality of your output, and do more of what you do, increase the quantity of your output. 5. Practice asking and listening. Ask and listen, and you'll obtain raw material for reaching sound decisions. Remember, big people monopolize the listening. Small people monopolize the talking. 6. Stretch your mind. Get stimulated. Associate with people who can help you think of new ideas, new ways of doing things. Mix with people of different occupational and social interests. Chapter 6. You are what you think you are. It's obvious. Much human behavior is puzzling. Have you ever wondered why a salesperson will greet one customer with an alert, "Yes, sir, may I serve you?" but virtually ignore another? Or why a man will open a door for one woman but not for another? Or why an employee will consistently carry out the instructions of one superior but only grudgingly do what another superior requests? Or why we will pay close attention to what one person says, but not to another? Look around you. You'll observe some people receiving the "Hey, Mac," or "Hey, buddy" treatment, while others receive the sincere and important "Yes, sir" treatment. Watch. You'll observe that some people command confidence, loyalty, and admiration, while others do not. Look closer still, and you'll also observe that those persons who command the most respect are also the most successful. What is the explanation? It can be distilled into one word: thinking. Thinking does make it so. Others see in us what we see in ourselves. We receive the kind of treatment we think we deserve. Thinking does make it so. The fellow who thinks he is inferior, regardless of what his real qualifications may be, is inferior. For thinking regulates actions. If a man feels inferior, he acts that way, and no veneer of cover-up or bluff will hide this basic feeling for long. The person who feels he isn't important isn't. On the other side, a fellow who really thinks he is equal to the task is. To be important, we must think we are important, really think so. Then others will think so too. Here again is the logic. How you think determines how you act. How you act, in turn, determines how others react to you. Like other phases of your personal program for success, winning respect is fundamentally simple. To gain the respect of others, you must first think you deserve respect. And the more respect you have for yourself, the more respect others will have for you. Test this principle. Do you have much respect for the fellow on Skid Row? Of course not. Why? Because the poor fellow doesn't respect himself. He's letting himself rot away from lack of self-respect. Self-respect shows through in everything we do. Let's focus our attention now on some of the specific ways we can increase self-respect and thereby earn more respect from others. Look important. It helps you think important. Rule: remember, your appearance talks. Be sure it says positive things about you. Never leave home without feeling certain you look like the kind of person you want to be. The most honest advertisement ever appearing in print is the "Dress Right, You Can't Afford Not To" slogan, sponsored by the American Institute of Men's and Boys' Wear. This slogan deserves to be framed in every office, restroom, bedroom, and schoolroom in America. In one ad, a policeman speaks. He says, "You can usually spot a wrong kid just by the way he looks." Sure, it's unfair, but it's a fact. People today judge a youngster by appearance, and once they've tabbed a boy, it's tough to change their minds about him, their attitude toward him. Look at your boy. Look at him through his teacher's eyes, your neighbor's eyes. Could the way he looks, the clothes he wears, give them the wrong impression? Are you making sure he looks right, dresses right, everywhere he goes? This advertisement, of course, refers primarily to children. But it can be applied to adults as well. In the sentence beginning with "look," substitute the word "yourself" for "him," "your" for "his," "superiors" for "teachers," and "associates" for "neighbors," and repeat the sentence. Look at yourself through your superior's eyes, your associate's eyes. It costs so little to be neat. Take the slogan literally. Interpret it to say, "Dress right, it always pays." Remember, look important because it helps you to think important. Use clothing as a tool to lift your spirits, build confidence. An old psychology professor of mine used to give this advice to students on last-minute preparations for final examinations. Dress up for this important exam. Get a new tie, have your suit pressed, shine your shoes. Look sharp because it will help you think sharp. The professor knew his psychology. Make no mistake about it. Your physical exterior affects your mental interior. How you look on the outside affects how you think and feel on the inside. All boys, I'm told, go through the hat stage. That is, they use hats to identify themselves with the person or character they want to be. I will always remember a hat incident with my own son, Davy. One day, he was dead set on being the Lone Ranger, but he had no Lone Ranger hat. I tried to persuade him to substitute another. His protest was, "But Dad, I can't think like the Lone Ranger without a Lone Ranger hat." I gave in finally and bought him the hat he needed. Sure enough, donning the hat, he was the Lone Ranger. I often recall that incident because it says so much about the effect of appearance on thinking. Anyone who has ever served in the Army knows a soldier feels and thinks like a soldier when he is in uniform. A woman feels more like going to a party when she is dressed for a party. By the same token, an executive feels more like an executive when he is dressed like one. A salesman expressed it to me this way: "I can't feel prosperous, and I have to if I'm going to make big sales, unless I know I look that way." Your appearance talks to you, but it also talks to others. It helps determine what others think of you. In theory, it's pleasant to hear that people should look at a man's intellect, not his clothes. But don't be misled. People do evaluate you on the basis of your appearance. Your appearance is the first basis for evaluation other people have. And first impressions last, out of all proportion to the time it takes to form them.